Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited for this week's show. It is a show that we've done every year for the last few years, at least. Looking back on our favorite horror movies of 2017 for this very special episode, I am joined, of course, fresh off her signing at Dark Delicacies for her book Monster Squad, available on Amazon.com right now. Please welcome back Heather Wixon. Hi, Heather.
Hey, thank you, Hype Man Bromley.
I literally ran out of breath on that one.
Oh my goodness, you really put it in there. You were like my you're like my Flavor Flav, right?
I got the big clock and everything.
I know, and the sizzle, don't forget.
Stop it with the sizzle. Stop trying to make sizzle happen.
It's a new thing, everybody, on Twitter. When you refer to Patrick, refer to him as the sizzle. That is all. I've so deemed it, and so it shall be.
Oh, please never do.
Oh, my God, this is going to be amazing.
Congratulations on your signing. That is super cool.
Thank you. It was really, really crazy weird, just because I've been to so many events at Dark Dells over the years, and to be on the other side of the table was like, I just kind of sat there and I was like, holy shit, is this really happening? And just being able to bring out some really great artists, and it was kind of like a little mini reunion for them. You know, they kind of run into each other here and there, but in not very often sometimes. So everybody seemed to really just like enjoy hanging out, and, you know, other effects people kind of came in and were there to kind of show their support. And it was stupidly surreal. Like, I don't understand how that just was a thing. But it was, and it was really fun. And I'm super, super grateful to Del and Sue for making it possible, because they really went out of their way to, you know, be awesome to me. And it's like, this is how stupid my mind was. I actually emailed Sue this week because I didn't know if I should bring pens. Like, this is how little I know about doing a book signing. I'm like, do I bring pens? Do they have pens? What do we do about pens? Like, I had a panic attack at 2 a.m. and had to send an email. And I was like, Sue, do I need to bring pens? What kind of pen should I bring? Do you have any that, like, I feel like such an idiot. But she was super nice. So, yeah, it was, it feels a little more real now. I think it'll feel ultimately real once I get the second one done and out, and then I can kind of take a step back from everything and realize, like, okay, time to move forward. But it's been awesome, and I'm so lucky, and thank you, everybody. I know a lot of folks on F This Movie have been, you know, writing about it, which, you know, the checks are in the mail, guys. Don't cash them for like another 5 years, but they're totally on their way. And I'm just really grateful to everybody who's either like tweeted to me or like sent me an email and stuff, and just been really supportive. Like, I wasn't, not that I was expecting people to be jerks or anything, but I didn't know if people would want to read this. And it seems like they do, and it's really been awesome.
It is awesome. Congratulations. Yeah, our site has basically just turned into a Heather Wixon fan site. So
excellent. I'll go ahead and just book some advertising with you while we're at it.
You know
it.
What? That would be great. That
Super.
Would be terrific.
Okay, well, don't cash that check for 5 years.
We're going to talk about our favorite horror movies of last year. We would have done this last week. I was sick. I'm just still getting my voice back. And, you know, we've talked before that 2017 was a really good year for horror in general, not just at the movies, but, you know, on TV and in print, basically everywhere. And Heather and I now both co-host a show over at Daily Dead called Corpse Club. Maybe you've heard of it. We have both published lists of our favorites over at Daily Dead. So I feel like we're going to be repeating ourselves a bit here, and I apologize for those of you
who only listen
to F This Movie. Great. This will be fun for you. Those of you who follow us elsewhere, I'm sorry. It's just that our favorite stuff is not hard to come by. So we may repeat ourselves a bit, but I'm excited to talk about this. I always enjoy doing this show.
Yeah, we are sluts for favorites. So we're just out here to give it all away. As many times
I would much
as
rather be called a slut for favorites than I would sizzle, which isn't even a thing.
It's the sizzle. It's not just sizzle.
All right.
You are the sizzle. Trust me on
this. I like the two Z's, but there's nothing else about it that I like.
But just imagine like a really great like 80s style jacket with like rhinestones on the back that says the sizzle, and you walk into Flashback wearing that, and everyone's going to know, oh shit, it's the sizzle.
If it was like just my middle name, like in quotes, like kind of 80s wrestling style, I could be a little bit more on board with it.
All right. Well, we can make it happen.
Can I get tights with my face airbrushed on the butt?
Yes, a la Rick Rude. Yes, of course.
Yes, a la Rick Rude.
Come on.
I was Googling something recently. Oh my gosh, I can't remember what it was. I was doing an image search for something that was like movie
Cases
related.
Cases on Butts?
No, it was something movie related. And everything that was coming back was Ravishing Rick Rude. What the hell was? I can't remember, but it
Google
was like.
Google was super on that day.
All of the image searches were Ravishing Rick Rude. It did make me miss him, I'll admit.
Yeah, he was awesome. It was funny because actually there was an event a few weeks ago where one of like these young upstart guys from NXT, which is like the lower tier, he actually did his tights a la Ravishing Rick Rude. And I immediately fell in love and I was like, I am on board with this kid. So in case anybody's watching, it's all about the Velveteen Dream.
Did you go into the ring and kiss him and then faint?
Oh, I wasn't there in person. I was watching.
Oh,
on the,
got
on
it.
The, but I did make out with the TV.
Okay, like, good.
A little bit. Just a little bit.
All right, let's get into our favorites. Now, I think for the first time, well, I won't spoil things. Never mind. Ignore what I just said, everyone.
Ignore everything.
What? Go ahead with your number 10.
Okay. So this is the first year where I don't have any that are like I'm throwing them in because like, well, they kind of count. Like, it's really like it was Sophie's choice trying to figure out the 10 horror movies because there's 10 really great horror movies this year. More so, I would even say,
yeah,
than
definitely.
10. I'm going to cheat on 10 and 9.
That's fine.
Because 10, there's two movies I really wanted to talk about. So I'm going with those and I'm going to do Prevenge from Alice Lowe and Happy Death Day from Chris Landon. And I don't know if anybody's seen Prevenge, which I believe is a Shudder exclusive.
It is.
I have been in love with Alice Lowe for years. And when I heard that she was going to take on, you know, directing a film, and I just knowing her sensibilities as an actress, I was like, oh, I know I'm going to love this. And I did. I thought Prevenge was a really interesting look at sort of those fears of motherhood. We've seen those movies before. But I think her take on it is very distinct. It's very atypical. And I think she confronts a lot of issues that other stories have been sort of afraid to confront when it comes to the conflict that, eventual mothers face, you know, when they have this thing growing in them and they kind of, you know, there's, you know, her character kind of hates the baby and the baby's manipulating her, or maybe it isn't. It's, you know, it's kind of a psychological slasher kind of, it's a lot of different things, but I think the way that she handles the material is something very special. And I loved it. I loved the little touches that she does where like after every kill, she kisses all of her victims on the forehead, like, you know, as only a mother would do. I think the final moments of the film are just gut-wrenchingly, you know, beautiful. It's just such a very unusual movie that we get. As I mentioned, you know, it's not weird to throw motherhood and horror together, but I think she did something really special with it. And because, you know, I'm always up for a slasher mystery. I have to pay, you know, a little bit of love or give a little love to Happy Death Day because I really had fun. I wasn't expecting to have as much fun with it as I did. And I get people, you know, nitpick it or whatever, and I'm not gonna, you know, say you're wrong or anything like that, but you are. No, I'm just joking. But I really wasn't expecting I just wanted to have, you know, just a little, I just wanted to go and kick back for, you know, 90 minutes. And I think Christopher Landon is really unsung when it comes to modern horror. I think what he's been able to do, you know, with, you know, Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse, which is still a really, really, really fun movie that deserves all the love, Zombie Kitties Forever. He did some really cool stuff with the Paranormal, you know, franchise. And I just think Happy Death Day is like him just completely taking on a different subgenre. And he does a really great job of it. Like, it's, you know, as I said, like, I love atypical movies. And this is not your typical slasher by any means. I mean, it's sort of like the new cousin to like April Fool's Day in a way. Because you never see her die. It's always, it restarts literally right at that moment. And, you know, I have to say, like, I didn't know what to expect from Jessica Roth. I didn't see La La Land. I don't know.
She's
barely
in it.
Okay. Well, that, yeah. Okay. I don't know that I'll ever see La La Land. I don't know. I just, it just doesn't do anything for me, but I really like the fact that we get this character who starts off really unlikable, you know, and sort of gets a moment where she really kind of comes in her own, and it doesn't feel forced. It feels genuine. It's a really nice moment. The kills are really fun. I love the look of the mask. I just thought it was a really fun movie. And I think, you know, in terms of, if you talk about a banner year for Blumhouse, I don't think they had a better year than 2017.
No, they definitely didn't, because, you know, they had a bunch of success with movies that I think were generally pretty good. You know,
yeah,
they've had successful movies.
Split, but I would say that's a great movie, like, for a lot of people. I had problems with it, but I'm so glad it did as well as it did, because I think there's good things in it.
Right. Yeah, I don't think there's like a Ouija on their resume this year, you know? It's like everything was pretty good in its own way.
Yeah, but for every Ouija, there's a Ouija Origin of Babel.
Sure. No, listen, absolutely. I like both of the movies that you just named. I didn't put them on my list, and so I'm thrilled that they're on yours, because we get to talk about them. I think they're both good at being what they are. You know, Happy Death Day, I was kind of not dreading, but I don't know. There was just something about the premise, obviously, that was familiar because it's Groundhog Day. But then I was also like, I don't know. Do I want to watch a movie where, like, I'm supposed to like a main character and then have to watch her die again and again? And to Christopher Landon's credit, and to the screenwriter's credit, and to Jessica Roth's credit, they do it in a way that isn't unpleasant, that doesn't feel mean-spirited. You know, like, oh, watching this, the heroine die again and again. They find a way to do it that feels, for lack of a better word, fun. And yeah, it's just a fun slasher movie that, for all its success, and I'm thrilled that it's successful, because maybe we'll get more slasher movies. I also, and they could clearly prove me wrong, but, like, it seems like they can't really sequelize it, which is great. You know, like, it's nice to have just kind of a one and done. Now, of course, tomorrow they could write Happy Death Day 2 and whatever. But it does seem like the kind of movie that is fairly closed ended. And that makes me happy, too, because it means that we'll probably get another original slasher movie instead of Happy Death Day 2, is my hope, you know. And Prevenge, yeah, I love that movie exists. I don't know that it worked for me as well as it did for you, but I just love the whole concept so much. I love the fact that she made it while she was actually pregnant.
What a freaking right? morning. She was 7 months pregnant. I know. Like, she was just a little pregnant.
And
like,
she's writing and directing and starring, and it's this crazy goddamn movie. Yeah, I'm it's so singular, and I'm so glad that it exists.
Yeah, it's, you know, and that's the thing that I really love. Like, we, it seems like, you know, if you go back to our episodes where we did this, like, maybe like 4 years ago, most of our choices were pretty much independent movies, because studio was kind of, you know, maybe there's one, maybe there's two. But, like, it's funny, like, as you see the years go on, like, it's a pretty steady mix of great indie and great studio stuff. And I'm just like, if you don't understand how awesome that is as a fan, like, I feel really sad for you, because there's so many options out there. I mean, I could have done a list of 20 movies for this, but that would have been like a 6-hour episode, and Right. Nobody needs that.
I think this was the best year for studio horror since I don't know when. I mean, I would have to look at, like, when the last year, when it was this good, you know, because, as you said, we might get one or two, but this year there were half a dozen, I would say, and that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. So what did you go for with number 10?
My number 10 is definitely more of just personal preference, and I went with Victor Crowley, and I went with it more for, I feel like, what it represents than for it being, like, a great horror movie, because I would say there's some movies maybe on my honorable mentions that are just better made, you know? But I, as a fan of Adam Green, as a fan of the Hatchet franchise, I just like that he made this movie in secret. I think it's a really fun celebration of being a slasher movie in the way that Happy Death Day kind of is. I won't reveal, you know, who's in the cast, but almost everyone that shows up is someone that you're happy to see. I think it's ambitious in ways that some of the past Hatchet movies haven't necessarily been, in terms of what he's doing technically at times. But mostly, you know, and I wrote this a little bit in my write-up on Daily Dead. Like, this was a year where we lost two of the giants of horror. And he's told the story before that the reason he made Victor Crowley was because George Romero basically said, like, why would you not keep that going? You know, he didn't want to be pigeonholed as the hatchet guy. And George Romero was like, well, why not? Your fans love that. That's what they want. Why wouldn't you do that for them? And that's kind of what got him to make another Hatchet movie. And so, you know, the idea that in 2017, even on the pretty micro indie level, we do have a slasher franchise that's still going. And we saw a few that they tried to reboot this year with Jigsaw and Cult of Chucky, which will come up again in a few minutes. But I'm happy that, like, there's a filmmaker who's kind of leaning into this and saying, like, yeah, let's celebrate this thing that I made. Let me give another one as sort of a gift to the fans of this franchise. And the way he kind of rolled it out as a big surprise, I just thought was really cool. So I enjoyed the movie a lot. I recognize that a lot of it had to do with, like, being at the screening and he's there and, you know, all the fans there are having a great time and cheering and all that. So, of course, the audience experience added to my enjoyment of the film. I'm sure if I watch it at home, maybe it won't work as well. But I think more than anything, I wanted to put it on the list because of what it represents for the genre.
Okay, so here's the thing, and I'm gonna say this because you did something that I don't think you should have to do. You don't have to quantify why you like something.
Oh, no,
you
don't. I know.
No. I just want to say, like, and this is in general to most people because a lot of folks do this. And I think we need to realize that you don't have to keep apologizing. I think maybe it's because I saw the A.D. Bryant thing on Saturday Night Live where she's talking about how girls always have to apologize for things. And that was like 110% on the money. You don't have to quantify it by that he was there. You freaking had a great time. That's awesome. And I still kick myself that we actually had plans at night. Like, I never make plans to do anything. And we had plans at night. And I'm like, well, it's Hatchet. Like, right, I've already seen Hatchet a million times. Like, okay. You know, so I didn't get to go and see it in LA. And maybe it would have made my list, too, because I gotten to see it. I'm going to have to wait until February, like everybody else or most people who didn't get a chance to see it in theaters. Because I don't think he screened it again in LA after when he took it on the road. And I was like, well, dude, like, not everybody was there that night. Sorry. You know, so I'm going to have to wait until the Blu-ray comes out. But I'm excited. Like, Hatchet was sort of where it all kind of began for me.
Yeah.
So I'm always excited to see it keep going. For as much as, you know, I agree that George is like, yeah, you should embrace being the Hatchet guy. I also want him to be the Frozen guy, though. And not that I want more Frozen movies, but I want more movies like Frozen and Digging Up the Marrow, too. I want him to find that balance. Like, give me three more Hatchets, but I want to see him do other things, too.
Yeah, I think he will.
He will, you know. But yeah, I don't ever, you don't have to quantify shit for anybody, Patrick. You do you.
Well,
that's
listen.
That's what the sizzle would do.
It's not that I'm qualifying it, I don't think. I'm just trying to explain, like, here's where I'm coming from, which I think is fair. I mean, that's really what we do on this show, is say, like, here's what I liked or here's what I didn't like and here's the reason why. So I think that's what I was trying to do. I wasn't, because I've never apologized. I've been pretty forthright in saying, like, yeah, I enjoy these movies. I like Adam Green's stuff, you know, and I'm not apologetic towards that. I just know that there are going to be certain people listening thinking, like, well, why would that be on your list but not Annabelle Creation, right? Well, I didn't see Annabelle Creation, but also because I felt a personal connection to this movie that I didn't feel with some other movies. That's all.
I would have been completely shocked if it wasn't on your list.
Yeah.
So take that guy who thinks that it shouldn't be on the list. Talk to me. I'll set you straight.
What's your next one?
Okay. So the next one, I cheated again. But I was really torn between two different, very different coming of age movies that completely.
I know one of them, and I should have put it on my list.
Okay, well, that's okay. That's why we do this. So we could talk about 27 different movies.
That's right.
Everybody strap in. But I went with a double feature of Raw and Super Dark Times.
Okay.
Raw, I actually saw back in 2016, but I'm one of those sticklers where I'm like, I don't count it until the official release.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, it's okay to kind of wait a little bit, because I feel like it's more relevant to people who are listening, because just because I'm a jerk who got to see it at a film festival, you know, doesn't You know what I mean? Like, there's not a real conversation that people care about, you know, when it's a year in advance. But man, did that movie I wasn't expecting the humor of it. And that final shot with her parents is just like pitch perfect. Really good gore, really great story. Garance is just absolutely wonderful as this, you know, girl who's conflicted about these things that are happening to her, and the dynamic that she has with her sister, like, is I'm an only child, so I don't really know. My closest would be to Jenna, and I'll tell you, that was kind of like me and Jenna sometimes growing up, like, because we were always together because we lived two houses from each other, but we would just push each other's buttons sometimes, most of the time, and that's why I love her. But I just thought, like, it really kind of, you know where it's going, like, the minute she eats the meat, you know where this is headed. And yet the way that Julia DeCorno, and I'm probably totally butchering that, DeCorno, right. Okay, presents these ideas that a lot of women face, you know, especially when you're a teenager and you're struggling with a lot of things, with your identity, with being able to fit in, with peer pressure, with the things that are kind of happening in your mind and, you know, in your body. Like, it was such a thoughtful examination of this, you know, troubled girl who just is desperate to kind of figure this all out and control it and keep away, you know, keep finding a way to, like, you know, keep her, you know, I'm trying to find humanity, you know, still there because she's still fighting these urges. Like, I just thought it was incredible. And like some of the dance numbers were great. And like, I just loved how it wasn't afraid to go to anywhere. Like, you know, there's some really uncomfortable scenes in that movie, but they needed to be. Like, you couldn't just make this movie. There's no light version of this story. And I love that the director was just like, no, we're going to tell this and we're going to go there. And she does a great job. And I think the same could be said for Super Dark Times. Funny enough, I actually saw that this year at Fantastic Fest. And, you know, we both were sort of teenagers in the 90s, although some of us were, you know, at least 1 year older.
Take it easy.
But I swear to God, like 10 minutes into this movie, and I felt like I was like in high school again, watching my friends. It also helped that the two leads, Owen Campbell and Charlie Tahan, like, looked just like two of my best guy friends that I had in high school, Bill and Rich, because like the three of us would always hang out and they looked almost like it. I should post a photo. It's really scary. But if you wanted to know what it was like to, you know, for, you know, as ancient folks to be a teenager in the 90s and sort of grow up in that environment. And there was a lot of uncertainty with the economy, with the world at large that was going on at that time. Like, it's, you know, Kevin Phillips, you know, does a really, really great job of handling some really difficult material. And, you know, of course, a lot of that's due to the writers. I know it's Ben and Luke.
Ben Collins and Luke Petrosky.
Okay, if I would have actually prepared for this, I would have remembered that off the top of my head, but I'm a jerk.
I think that's right.
I think you're right. Yeah.
The guys that wrote Siren.
Yes, that's him. But if you haven't seen Super Dark Times, and I think it might be on Netflix now.
It is on Netflix.
It's so good. If you're a youngin', if you're a millennial and you're like, well, you know, how do those old folks live? This is what you're going to be introduced to most of our teenage years. And anybody who grew up during that era, it's exactly how you remember it. So I just, the two, for me, I couldn't choose between those two. So I had to kind of cheat, and I won't cheat anymore, I promise.
No, I think it's fine. Super Dark Times is one of those that was like on my sort of honorable mentions, and Raw is actually much higher up on my list, but I like, as you said, they're both coming of age stories. And I think Raw is, while there are certain universalities in both, I think Super Dark Times is very specifically a male coming of age story, and very specifically
Absolutely.
About how young men relate to one another, how they talk to one another, what their concerns are. And when shit goes bad, sort of, it's not the way that it would happen necessarily with young women, whereas Raw is very specifically a young female coming of age story. So I love that we got these sort of very specific, very well observed coming of age stories for both genders from two different voices, you know, that we have a female doing this female story and these men writing this male story. Raw, you know, I'll bring it up again in a little bit when it shows up on my list, but I think it's just amazingly made. I think those two performances are so good. And you had brought up some of the places that the movie goes and some of the, you know, I guess, gruesomeness, which you're going to have when it's a cannibal story. And I remember hearing that, you know, people had passed out at screenings and stuff. And I was watching it just waiting for it to go super gory, and it doesn't. And what's brilliant about it is, like, it's a small moment, sort of. You know, there are much gorier things that happen in other movies this year, but I'm speaking specifically about The Finger. Okay, we'll call it that. The way that it's handled is so, I don't know, it's like that's what it would really be like. And there's something about how realistic it feels that makes it so much more effective and so much harder to take than the really over the top gore that shows up in other movies.
Yeah. And also, I think for me, like, the worst part of that movie was probably, and maybe this is coming from a female perspective, is the waxing scene. Like, it's not even the waxing. Like, it's just, you know, like even if you've just ever had your eyebrows waxed, which, like, I actually just went and did for my, you know, book signing, so I didn't look like a dude out of the middle age or the Stone Ages, which was happening. You know that pain just from your eye. Like, it's again, and it's probably one of those moments where I think, you know, women probably cringed more than men, but there's men probably going like, oh my God, why are we doing this? Like, and it probably forced them to think about things that they never really thought about. And I just like that it was very unflinching. And what's really interesting too, and I think I'm right on this, is that I think both directors were first-time feature filmmakers.
I believe you are right. Yeah, Julie DeCormo had made Raw as a short.
Yeah.
And then expanded it, yeah.
So, and actually, I think because, you know, Alice Lowe is a first-time director as well. I mean, it's just kind of cool that there's a lot of directors on my list this year, and it's their first time doing a feature, and it's pretty damn hard to come out of the gate swinging as hard as a lot of filmmakers did this year, and that's awesome. It's only good things for, you know, the rest of us.
Four out of my top five are first-timers.
Dang.
Right? All right.
Look at that. Go get them.
My next pick is a movie that I wanted to show a little love to and honestly probably wouldn't have made my list. But then I rewatched it yesterday or the day before and found it way more effective than I did even the first time I watched it. And I liked it the first time. But that is Jackals, which is the latest film from Kevin Greutert, the editor of several Saw movies, who made Saw 6 the best Saw movie. But then
it's
also
Grudert. It's Grudert.
Is it Grudert?
Yes.
Okay. Grudert. Yeah. Sorry. But then he also made The Final Chapter. Yes.
Yes. He also did Jezebel too. I mean, Jezebel as well. I don't know if there's a Jezebel too.
I don't think I saw Jezebel.
It was pretty good. It had, I'm totally blanking on the gal's name from Predestination. I really liked her.
I know who you're talking about.
Dang, she's so cute and she's really good.
Sarah Snook.
Yes,
bam.
I love her.
Look at me.
Coming up in Winchester.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right. Anyway, so Jackals. sorry about my cough, everyone. I try not to do it on the show. Bear with me. Jackals is just, like, really dark and really unrelenting. It's essentially, you know, about a Stephen Dorff plays a cult deprogrammer who kidnaps a guy who's in a cult and brings him home to the family. And the dad is played by Jonathan Scheck and the mom is Deborah Kara Unger. And he has a wife and a new baby and he's going to essentially deprogram him from this cult. And then the cult shows up at the house and they are standing outside and they're in spooky animal masks. And it's just really kind of unrelenting. It's not exactly a home invasion movie, but that's very much the vibe of it. It's essentially humorless. It's pretty brutal. Really good performances all around. Stephen Dorff is really, really great in it. And it's not always my kind of horror movie. I don't always like my horror movies this grim, but I just couldn't deny how effective it was. And this is completely unrelated to why it's on my list, but it actually started life as a Tobe Hooper movie. Jared Rivett had written it and was going to make it with Tobe Hooper, and that ended up not happening. But it did get made, which I'm happy about, and was put out by Scream Factory. It was like a pickup for them. I think it's really, really a strong piece of work.
Yeah, I liked it. Again, I think, you know, in any other year, it might have made like my honorable mentions, because there's some really good stuff in it. You know, Stephen Dorff, it was an interesting year to be Stephen Dorff, because you have this and you have Texas Chainsaw, or Leatherface. Sorry. I'm so sorry. How could I get that mixed up? You know, and, you know, good for Stephen Dorff on making a comeback. I mean, I don't know if I call Leatherface a comeback, but I did like Jackals. I think there was some really good unsettling stuff, some good visuals, especially, you know, the nighttime scenes, which can be a nightmare to get right. And I like the script. But yeah, if it had been any other year, like if we had done this 5 years ago, Jackals might have made my list. In fact, I think it was just because I didn't think I formally reviewed it. I don't remember. I think I did an interview or something for it. I can't remember. But yeah, I had fun with it. Like I was happy to see Scream Factory give it a home. Because I think it's a really fun movie. Is that one on Netflix too now, or is it still
not
just Blu-ray?
Not yet. I guess I'm guessing it will be eventually, but yeah, it's just on Blu-ray right now.
Yeah. I think it's a really solid movie. You know, and I like that it's being talked about, because I'm a jerk and I didn't do it. So, sorry.
Well, right. But that, again, that's why we do these lists, because as I was saying just before we started recording, you know, I would rather talk about more movies than fewer. And so, yes, could I have thrown something else in this spot? Maybe. But why not get some people to maybe watch Jackals, you know? And again, I think it helps, too. You had brought up the Stephen Dorff connection and Leatherface. I watched Leatherface last week, and I know you saw it because I remember you texting me saying it's a movie. I think Leatherface is going for the same kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? I think it's going
for
that same tone. And so you put these two movies side by side, and I think Jackals does it really, really well, and I think Leatherface does it very, very poorly.
And was I wrong, though, that they picked the absolute wrong character to be, quote-unquote, Leatherface?
And like, I know they think that's, like, a clever misdirect.
But we don't need a misdirect. That's not, you know, we're not watching Scooby-Doo. We're watching Texas Chainsaw.
And again,
it's pretty standard.
Are you ever going to watch Texas Chainsaw and be like, oh, that's the person under the mask? Like, no, this movie is immediately being rejected from our brains.
Well, that's okay. I think we have a new reboot coming in a few years anyway. So ready, everybody. Thank God.
Thank goodness. What is next for you?
All right. Well, I for my next choice, I went with a movie that gave me all the naughty feels.
Oh.
Yeah, I have a 6-way tie for this one, kids. I went with a movie that gave me all the naughty feelings. And that would be Patrick Bryce's Creep 2.
Oh, you know what? I haven't seen this yet. I feel terrible.
Oh, you should.
I'm going to.
You were going to fall so in love with Mark Duplass if you're not already in love with him.
I am already.
But I just, okay, so here's the thing. Like, I didn't even see the first Creep, like, when it came out. Like, I'm a total jerk, but I think it came out at a time when I was busy, like, and it never stuck on my radar. You know, it's always hard keeping up with what I have to watch, so I don't get to watch stuff for fun anymore most days. So when Creep 2 was coming out and they were like, oh, you want to do interviews? I was like, okay, sweet. So I went and watched the first Creep and I liked it. I thought it was really great. Love that last final shot. I thought the dynamic between Patrick Bryce, who also is acting in that movie, and Mark Duplass was fantastic, where you just don't even know what the hell is going on anymore. And so the thing is, it's like the two things that I think, you know, Creep 2 immediately, you know, and I'm going to keep this very ambiguous for you so I don't ruin anything. But the two things coming into this is, like, one, they're making a found footage movie, and they're making a found footage movie sequel. So right out of the gate, it's tough. Like, how do you do that and find a way to make it not only work, but be a great movie and feel like it's just as strong as the original? And somehow, like, I don't know if they, like, did some sort of, like, movie voodoo or something. Like, they summoned some sort of found footage god, really dug into what makes the character of Aaron so interesting, and then gave him this person to kind of be this, like, bounce off, you know, in terms of Desiree Akhavan, sorry, and I apologize because I know she has a film coming up at Sundance. She's, you know, a filmmaker in her own right. and just completely screw with you as an audience member the entire time. And then I love the fact that the movie is really Desiree and Mark actually fucking with each other the whole time. Like, there's moments where they're like, you know, trying to scare each other around the house, and real. That was them really just screwing around, trying to scare each other. Like, there's a scene where, like, Mark's like, okay, I'm gonna, and then he's like, okay, now you get naked. That wasn't planned. Like, they were just like that day, and Mark was like, I'm just totally going to push her. And then she just pushes right back. And I think it's such an interesting dynamic that comes out of this movie where you don't even know who's playing who anymore. And you don't know where it's going to go. You don't know what the ultimate game is with Aaron or whatever Mark Duplass's name is, you know, his character's real name is. And it blew me away. And it also doesn't hurt that, like, the hot tub scene looks like it's straight out of a Fiona Apple video. You know, because, you know, Mark Duplass has been a bad, bad girl.
And, me too. You know,
saucy. So definitely bring in the sizzle. And I really appreciated what those guys did, because they did something really, really, really tough. You know, they did, you know, they came back to do more found footage, because some people just sort of, you know, they're like, okay, well, we did found footage, let's just do a traditional narrative, you know, and shoot it, you know, how you'd shoot a regular movie. But they're like, no, we're still going to do this, we're going to find a way to bring the camera into the story again, and we're going to completely up the game with the characters and with the audience. And hot damn, I really had fun with it. Like, I don't think there's been a day that's gone by that I haven't thought about Creep 2. And I just think what they really pulled off was special.
I need to watch it. I feel terrible. There were three or four movies that I didn't get to see before we did these lists, and that is definitely one of them. So I will check it out. Yeah, because the first Creep was like, oh, that movie shouldn't have worked, and did. And so there's no way a sequel should work, right? So I'm very happy to hear that it does as well.
Yeah. You'll have to let me know, like, the minute you finish it. Like, okay. You just have to, tell me.
Okay.
It's like that kind of movie.
All right. I'm in.
All right.
All right, my next pick is Cult of Chucky, and I had so much fun with it. You know, I don't have much to say about it beyond that. We actually did an entire episode of Corpse Club about it, so if you want to hear us expound on it some more, you can. But I just love where they're taking this franchise, and the fact that Don Mancini is kind of making it this crazy Fast and Furious universe where all of the characters from the past are coming back and all these different plot lines are intersecting, where they take Fiona Dourif's character, I was pretty fascinated by. It's sort of a rare horror installment that I think is fun. I think the mental hospital, or, you know, psychological rehabilitation facility is... a pretty fun setting. I think there's some pretty cool gags in it. But mostly it's sort of a rare horror sequel. And what
like
are we 45 at
45 movies
was
in
this
now?
No. Seven? I think this was seven
I
movies
think seven,
in.
Yeah.
Where like it ended and I'm anxiously hoping they make a part eight, you know, because I want to see where this crazy story continues to go. So it ended, and in the course of talking about it, I think on Corpse Club, I was like, yeah, I guess I'm a pretty big Child's Play fan, which I didn't realize, but sometimes it takes a movie to sort of pull everything into focus. I remember Fast Five being that movie where I was like, oh, it turns out I like this series. And Cult of Chucky was kind of like that for me, because I've liked most of the Child's Play movies to one degree or another. That might not even be an accurate statement, but this one kind of pulled a lot of stuff into focus, and I just really appreciated how it builds on everything that came before. It's not ignoring half the franchise. It's not necessarily trying to retcon stuff. It's just saying, like, yeah, this is all part of this same universe, and let's have a great time with it, which I did.
Yeah, it's actually higher on my list.
Okay.
You know, it's in my top five, actually.
Nice.
Because I didn't love Curse. Like, I liked Curse. But it wasn't my favorite. Like, I thought it was okay. Yeah, it was a Chucky movie.
And it was an interesting, kind of a reboot in terms of, like, okay, they took it in a different direction. It's kind of a big haunted house movie. It's not really until the end that it becomes like, oh, now it's every Child's Play movie. But it was an interesting way for sort of the franchise to, like, get back on its feet.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I like that you say that about a movie where the protagonist is in a wheelchair, you insensitive jerk.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. Way to go. Never mind. I don't want to go anywhere with that where I'd ruin anything. But what for me, what I really liked about Cult is because, you know, I like the first trilogy. I love Bride and Seed, and I will defend Seed until my last breath. So y'all can save it. Seed is so, so horribly underrated. And careful.
There's a lot of stuff I like in Seed, I promise.
All right. Look, I get the Britney Spears gag is dated, but
I forgot about that.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, so for me, to have that humorous slant where you're bringing in, you know, Jennifer Tilly and, you know, kind of doing that whole thing with Glenn and Glenda, and then to go back to sort of the serious straightforward, I was like, okay, I mean, it was good, but I really wanted something that felt like it wasn't trying to, pull the rug out of Bride, you know, from under Bride and Seed. So when you have Cult that comes along, you know, I was just like, holy shit, Don found a way to bring every, different tone of this franchise together, and it works. Yeah. It works really well. It has one of the best franchise kills in it. You know, I don't want to ruin too much for fans, but there's one scene with Chucky that completely blows my mind because it's something you have never seen in a Chucky movie before with this character. And I just think, you know, and because I'm a whore for my book, the fact that Tony Gardner does something, he could have just done the standard, oh, this is what we're going to do. And it blows your mind. And I don't want to ruin it for people, but it's such a cool scene. I just was wow. I was not expecting to laugh as much as I did. And there's some things that are kind of hokey about it. I don't give a shit. I had so much fun with it. And I love the final scene, you know, when we have, you know, Fiona and Jennifer Tilly, and it's just
Oh, it's one of the greatest things that's ever been put in a movie.
And think about this, is you have this franchise that's been primarily built around this male character of Charles Lee Ray with, you know, via Brad Dourif. And Brad is an amazing person, does amazing vocal work, you know, really is fun whenever he pops up in person in these films. But basically, you know, it's Don Mancini giving the keys, you know, handing over the keys to the franchise to two women.
Yeah.
And holy shit, I cannot wait. I hope we get three more movies with them. I would watch the hell out of anything that you give me with those characters. I'm all in.
Me too.
So, you know, don't screw this up, Universal. You've given us 45, you know, Scorpion King movies. We need at least one more Chucky.
Well, and the release of this movie was so crazy because, I mean, I know it got pirated early, unfortunately, which probably hurt it a little, but it was essentially released, you know, straight to DVD and Blu-ray. It showed up on Netflix the same day, and then it was on AMC within the month.
I don't understand it was what so the reasoning
strange.
Was behind that.
Yeah.
Because how do you
they
how
just
do you
were
get
trying
people to buy
your
Blu-ray?
They were trying to give it away. It's very strange. Very strange. But again, if you watched it on Netflix or obviously on AMC, you didn't see the uncut version. And I really think that's the version to see, not just because it has the extra gore, but also because it has additional post-credits scenes that are really cool.
Yes. And again, I just, you know, and the one thing that I said, in my favorites list for Daily Dead is to bring back Andy Barclay from the beginning, you know, we have Andy, you know, Alex Vincent from the first movie. We've all seen the original character come back to a franchise before, but they found a way to actually make it mean something. And that to me is what sets it apart, because other franchises would have brought that character back and just made it this quick little thing. And Don was like, no, we're going to do something with this. And you can just tell with him, it all matters.
Well, and that is kind of what they did with the extra scene in Curse, right? It was exactly what you're describing. But then we get a whole new movie where all that it gets paid off. And that's really cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
What is next for you?
Okay, let me...
What are we on? Are we on six?
I think we're on my list. We are on six. So I'm going to go with one that's probably not going to be a huge surprise to you because you know my heart and you know what tickles my fancy. And it's always Emma Roberts. And I'm going to go with Blackcoat's Daughter.
Yeah.
I, you know, it was funny because I hadn't even seen Osgood Perkins' other films before seeing Blackcoat's Daughter, but I made sure to catch the hell up after.
It's
was
just one, right? Does he only have one other one?
I think, yeah.
I'm the pretty thing who
I
lives in the house.
I thought there was a short too.
Oh, there might be a short.
Yeah, I thought there was I think there was a short too or something that was online. But either way, you know, Anthony Perkins, you know, progeny, you figure this kid's probably grown up around movies and has a good understanding of, like, you know, certain things, because I'm sure, you know, being in that household has some influence. And, you know, I was so, like, moved by those final moments. Like, you see the moment where, like, in the trailer, where, like, you know, Emma Roberts is clutching her face and she's screaming in agony and she has blood on her hands. And you're like, okay, that's visually, like, that hits you. And then you see that moment in the context of the story. And I cried for this poor girl. And I think, you know, the way that they frame the story is very unusual. And I don't want to give it away for anybody who hasn't watched it. It is a super slow burn. So for anybody who doesn't feel like they are a patient viewer, maybe this movie isn't going to pay off for you in the way that it paid off for me. But I just think that there's something so sad and so beautiful, you know, where you have this story about a girl who feels so lost and so forgotten in her life that she basically is begging Satan to take her in, you know, and then we see how it all ties together, you know, with these different characters, and, you know, James Remar shows up. And I didn't even realize till after the fact that was Lauren Holly that was playing, the mom character. And I was like, oh my gosh. Okay. But I just think that there's something so uniquely beautiful about the way that they explore grief and explore, you know, basically wanting to belong and loss and feeling like, you know, you're an afterthought to, you know, the people that are supposed to love you, and the desperation that can lead you, you know, towards. It just, for me, like, it's one of my favorite things with Emma, and she's not even that much. She's not even really in it that much. It really is all about Kieran Shipka, who I think is great, and I'm so excited to see her as Sabrina the Teenage Witch. I'm like, oh, that's really cool.
That casting is amazing.
Right? And we have Axel Carolyn writing it too, which is super cool. But yeah, that movie to me was like, I don't know, maybe I just needed some really good, like, emotional movies this year, because it was just kind of one of those years. So maybe that's why movies like that sort of hit me the way that they did, like this and Ron, like Super Dark Times. But again, I think if anybody hasn't seen it, you know, and you know that you're cool with a slow burn. Again, I'm never going to begrudge anybody who needs their movies a little more quick paced. I don't. Like, I was ready to let that kettle boil, like, for the whole, you know, I think, 90 minutes or so.
Yeah.
Like, it just, I loved it. I wish I could re-see it for the first time again.
It's really strong. And again, especially as a debut film, it's a little bit, I have it a little bit higher up on my list, and we won't spend much time on it when I get to it. But I do feel like it's released this year, and I think I said something to this effect on my favorites list, but I do feel like when it finally came out, it was a little bit of like an afterthought, because so many people had already seen it, whether through festivals.
And it changed names and stuff,
exactly,
too.
Exactly. Like,
it was very confusing.
People saw it at festivals. It had been released overseas. So it was like, oh, here's this movie, finally, which is such a shame, because had it gotten a proper release and come out, you know, much sooner, and like you said, not gone through the name change or whatever, I really think it's a movie that would have blown a ton of people away. I mean, I do think it's still that movie, but I think it's now a movie that people are going to have to catch up to, instead of one that I think could have and should have kind of taken the genre by storm. Most of the people that I've talked to that have seen it have responded to it really well. Like you said, it's not going to be for everyone. And I love the fact that we can just finish talking about Cult of Chucky, which is like the seventh movie in this studio franchise. Completely ridiculous, completely over the top, just goofy as hell. Anything goes. And then the very next movie is like this very somber, very sad, more or less humorless, very quiet, slow burn horror film. Like, the genre's ability this year to sort of stretch in every possible direction and offer something for everyone is one of the things that I think was so great about horror in 2017.
Oh my god, yeah. I, like I said, it was like, If you would have been like, maybe this year we do 15, I would have had no problems mm-hmm. doing 15 movies. For and they sure. would have all been vastly different.
Yeah, yeah. My next pick is Psychopaths, which I know you hosted the screening of out in L.A., right?
I did, yeah. It was a lot of fun, but it was really funny because, like, it was supposed to be, like, maybe Mickey and a couple cast members. And because there was a lot of folks there who'd, like, worked on the film, Mickey kind of invited everybody up, and it was, like, half the theater, and I had to, like, do a Q&A with 20 people. But everybody was so excited. And I just thought it was, you know, it was really fun to sort of see everybody, you know, come together for this very unique vision. And I'm going to let you talk about Psychopaths, but I really, I really enjoyed it. And I know how I feel about Mickey. But I love that you have it on your list. And I don't know why I feel like that was this year, but it wasn't, it was last year. Cause it was like right at the beginning of December.
Yeah. I saw it, in November at Cinepocalypse, and then it got, you know, barely released in December, unfortunately. And you can, I think, you know, rent it or buy it on Amazon Video now for like $10. And there's a DVD, but of course no Blu-ray. So I'd probably have to buy it on Amazon Video so I can get it in HD because it's a really great looking movie. You know, I have an on again, off again relationship with Mickey Keating. I really love Darling. And I'm a little more lukewarm on some of his other movies. And every time I watch one of his films, I'm like, gosh, you're such a talented guy. Who are you, though, as a filmmaker? You know, like, what is your voice? Because he's such a good mimic. But, and, you know, he's so young. I just feel like so many of his movies are informed by the other movies he's seen. Even Darling is just Roman Polanski, you know. But with Psychopaths, which is still very, I don't want to say derivative, but it's clearly influenced by a lot of other things and other filmmakers. But I thought it came together in a way that I really started to feel like his voice coming out. And it's a crazy movie. It's over the top. It's weird sometimes for the sake of being weird. And honestly, for so much of it, I was like, I don't know if I'm totally on board with this. Like, it's beautiful and it's hypnotic and it's like fun to watch. But what's the purpose of it all? And then there's a bit of narration that Jeff Daniel Phillips gives at the end that is almost like a cinematic shrug. And that pulled the whole movie into focus for me. And I was like, oh, that's what you're doing. Okay. And I completely responded to it. And it really wasn't until, you know, in the days that followed where images from the movie or just the way the movie felt stuck with me in a way that a lot of other movies that I saw during that festival or that I saw all year long didn't. And it was a movie that I have wanted to return to, which is not always the case, you know. So I feel like for me, it's his most successful movie so far. And again, I'm a fan of him. And so I'm just very excited to see what he does next.
Yeah. I think for me, like what I loved about it is I think it's probably his most ambitious, which is funny because, you know, it's a pretty, compared to other films, it's pretty, I would, you know, say smaller scale. But I love the fact that there's a lot of things in this movie that he just, it's him definitely shooting from the hip. It's not as, I would say, as structured as a lot of his other films. But I'm good with that. And I think for me, what really worked, my very favorite aspect of the whole movie was Ashley Bell. Like, holy shit, did I love her in it? Like, I liked her in Carnage Park a lot. I've enjoyed a lot of things that she's done. There's a survival movie that WWE put out years ago called The Day, I think with Sean Ashmore. And I thought she was great in that. But how fun is she to watch in that movie? Like, she looks like she is having the time of her life. And the final scene with her, like, that's what made me fall in love with Psychopaths, where I was like, yes, exactly. All right. You know, and I think for me, like, you know, what you were saying in terms of Mickey's influence is always showing immensely in his movies. I think it's okay, you know, because, like, if you look at a movie like The Shape of Water, like, and Guillermo will tell you there's like 350 movies referenced in that movie. I think maybe the difference is that those references are buried a little bit more and you have to pull the layers away in some instances, where Mickey's, his heart's on his sleeve, like it's right out in front. And, you know, I feel like it's okay still, because I think, you know, this is something that he and I talked about when we did an interview back in December, is, you know, for him right now, he's making movies that celebrate the movie, like celebrates movie making. But doing it in different genres and different decades, you know, and in different subgenres and styles and approaches. And I think that's cool. Like, I think there's enough of him in those movies. Like, I think his least successful for me was Pod, because it just felt very much like an X-Files episode. Like, it was almost beat for beat, like a certain X-Files episode, which probably, maybe me and five other people would recognize. But so I think as he does more of these type of films, I think he's going to be able to rely less on his love of movies and find that love for his own voice, if that makes sense. But I really dig that you put it on there, because I think it's a really fun movie to talk about. Because I get anybody who's like, oh, that movie was, because it's not.
No, 100%.
It's not going to be, you know, for everybody's taste. No. Like, you know, one movie I was going to put on this list, but I didn't think it, you know, qualified, was like Bad Batch. And I know that that movie is made for very specific tastes, and that's okay. Like, it was, you know, Anna Lily Amanpour reading my dream journal, which is totally cool. But I know 9 out of 10 people are probably going to hate that movie, and I'm okay with that. Like, I know that. But I like the fact that this probably is one of Mickey's most challenging films, but I'm glad.
Yeah.
Because I feel like, you know, as much as I loved Carnage Park, and I really, really did, and I know you weren't as big of a fan, but like, that's a movie I could see more people enjoying because it's less confrontational in its material. And I like that, you know, Psychopath just kind of goes for it.
Yeah, I think there's a difference. You know, you brought up Shape of Water. I think there's a difference between inspiration and imitation. And I think Del Toro is inspired by every movie he's ever seen, in the way that Tarantino is inspired by every movie he's ever seen. And they all flow into him, and then something different kind of is vomited back out, right? Because they absorb all this stuff, and then something comes out through them that feels like their voice that's been inspired by all this other stuff. And for me, Psychopaths is the closest that Mickey Keating has gotten to inspiration instead of imitation, you know, where Carnage Park, okay, I'm doing this 70s survivalist thing, and Darling, I'm doing Roman Polanski in the 60s, and Pod, I'm doing one specific X-Files episode. And this, yes, you could certainly say, okay, well, this comes from Ken Russell, and this comes from De Palma, and this blah, 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 blah. But it feels more like it's finally flowing through Mickey Keating and his voice instead of him just imitating another genre that he loves, I guess is the distinction that I would make, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
What is next for you? This would be your sixth
or 23rd,
exactly,
I think, depending on how you're counting these. I apologize for coughing because I was still talking. So for my next pick, it's another feature film debut, going all the way to the land from down under, mate. And I'm going to go with Hounds of Love.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Have you seen it?
I have, yeah.
Okay. So this is a movie that I've seen three different times now. And yeah, I really have. And it's funny because this isn't like my type of movie, but the thing is, it isn't that type of movie that you think it is. And I'll tell you why in a second. So the first time I watched it, and you know, the situation with me and my mom, like, you know, for anybody who's listening, and I can say this, like, she didn't talk to me for 5.5 years, and I had, you know, no idea. And there's so much of the story, because even though it's this horrible, you know, kidnapping story about this couple, and it's based on real things that were happening in Australia in the 80s, where this couple, you know, takes this teenage girl and they keep her captive in their house. And it's so much more than that. And I got it a little bit the first time, but holy crap, did it set in the second time. And then the third time I was like, I was completely in it for Emma Booth, who plays, Evelyn, who is one of the kidnappers. And so for me, if anybody, I'm going to be really specific and vague, because if this isn't a movie you have seen and you were kind of worried about the material, it's not Captivity. It's not that kind of movie,
right,
at all. And I think that's a huge credit to Ben Young, because he could have gone that direction and he doesn't at all. This isn't a movie about kidnapping and torture. It is in a way, but it's more about this poor young girl who's stuck in this, you know, in this dynamic between these two people, and Emma Booth, who is this, you know, she's with this guy who really, like, she's so desperate for love, and she's lost her kids, and she's got nothing but Stephen Curry's character. And she's so desperate for his constant attention and his affection. And she just, it's really a story about mothers and their children. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think for me, that's why it hit me, because the first time I saw it, my mom and I still hadn't talked, and we actually reconnected in November. So for me, the first time I watched it, and there's the scene at the end, and I don't want to give anything away, but there's a song from Joy Division that hits, and it's called Atmosphere. And holy crap, like, because of the material, because of the fact that this is a story about, you know, parental love and acceptance and, you know, also strong women, I had to pause for a second, and I think I sobbed because I watched a screen on my computer. I was like sobbing at my computer, and it just really hit me. And then again, it's like, well, why would you watch a movie again about these people who torture this girl? And you realize that, you know, it is so much more than that, because you watch, you know, Emma Booth really pull the layers back. And the one thing that I noticed, and I talked to her because I got to do a Q&A for the film a few weeks back. One of the most interesting things to me is that her character, because she's the mother, the role, you know, even to this girl that they've kidnapped, she is the one who has to care for her. But she also has to nurture Stephen Curry's character, John. And she's all about nourishing everybody else and making sure that everybody else is taken care of and fed. We never see her character eat once in the movie, but we see her tending, you know, to Ashley Cummings, who plays Vicky, the young girl that they take, like, you know, her needing water, her needing this or that, you know, and every morning she has to wake up and make sure that, you know, her boyfriend John's, you know, breakfast is precisely the way that he wants it, you know, because we get inklings of his OCD. And there's so many really deeply thoughtful touches to that movie. And it's so embarrassing because, like, when I did the Q&A, like, I was like, okay, well, I've seen it twice. I'm cool now. Like, I'm good. And I'm sitting in the theater and that goddamn Joy Division song hits and I start crying. And then I have to go up in front of an audience filled with people. And I literally, I froze and I couldn't even remember the director's name. I was like, hi, everybody. I'm really a professional. Like, I totally froze in that moment because I was so caught up in it. Yeah. And the thing is, like, for as much as it, you know, deals with a lot of really uncomfortable things, it's a movie about hope.
Yeah.
It's a movie about love. It's a movie about, you know, not giving up. It's a movie about, you know, being able to come together, you know, as human beings. It really isn't about torture. It really isn't, you know, it isn't those icky things. I mean, those icky things exist in this movie.
Right.
But again, the way that he handles it is just, it's so well done.
Yeah.
And now that I've talked like 45 minutes on it.
No, I, you know, it's not on my list, but I think it's a really strong film. And I think, as you pointed out, the lead performance from Emma Booth is amazing. And if, you know, genre films ever got any actual awards attention, I think she would be talked about. And as you said, I always appreciate when a horror film, I don't want to say, you know, has a happy ending, because I don't want to say that this movie's ending is happy or sad or spoil anything. But there's little that pisses me off more than horror movies that just shit on your goodwill just for the sake of, like, aren't we nasty?
Right.
And you see it all the time. It's just like, anytime a character is like, I can't believe I made it, you know that, you know, the next thing that's going to happen to them is they're going to be shot or stabbed or die.
It's his last day before retirement.
Right, exactly. And it's just, oh, we get it. Aren't you bleak? And I so appreciate that this movie, you know, is pretty dark and is pretty rough at times. But as you said, is ultimately hopeful. And that's a hard thing to do. And honestly, even you talking about it just now made me appreciate it, I think, more than I did when I watched it. So I'm really happy to hear you talk about it.
Yeah. And it earns the ending, too. Like, I don't feel like
Absolutely.
It was just, you know what I mean? Like, you go through these things with these characters
right.
where it doesn't feel like, the ending doesn't feel out of place compared to the rest of the movie.
Right.
But yeah, if it's a movie that you haven't seen, 'cause you're like, oh, why do I want to go watch a movie about two people who torture a girl? It isn't that. It isn't. And like you said, like, if this movie, you know, starred like maybe like two sort of somewhat notable actors from, you know, the U.S. and, you know, had a somewhat notable U.S. director, this would be like all over festival, like all over awards.
Yeah.
Because it's that good. Like, Emma and that character of Evelyn is so well done. Like, you could watch that character 10 times over and find something new about it, like that performance.
Yeah. Yeah. If you are a Hulu subscriber. I know it's streaming on Hulu. I don't know if it's elsewhere, but that's how I watched it. So it is, you know, I'm sure you can rent it or whatever, but it's also out there on Hulu. My next pick, we actually haven't talked about yet, which is surprising. And that is Gerald's Game, the Mike Flanagan Netflix original starring Carla Gugino and Bruce Greenwood. I read the book when it first came out. I remember thinking, well, they'll never make a movie out of this for a number of reasons. One being that it's essentially a one-person story about a woman handcuffed to a bed. Two, because it goes to some pretty dark places. And I remember Mike Flanagan being on, I think it was still Killer POV. It might have been Shockwaves already. I don't remember, but he was a guest on there. And they kind of said, like, hey, do you ever, you know, do you have any dream projects? And he said, yeah, Gerald's Game. And then a few months later, he was announced as the director of Gerald's Game. And I was excited about that because I knew he was going to, you know, go for it. And boy, does he. There's some stuff in the movie that I still can't quite reconcile. And I know I'm not alone in that. There's some stuff from the ending that I don't love. It's from Stephen King's book, so I'm not blaming Mike Flanagan. I just don't like that stuff as much, but I thought it found ways to be genuinely scary. I thought the performances by Carla Gugino, I think, is the best she's ever been. I think Bruce Greenwood is amazing. I think Mike Flanagan figured out a way to make the sort of one-person narrative work in a really interesting way, and I think it has one of the standout horror sequences of the year. I just thought it was really, really well done in a year where we got a lot of good Stephen King, you know.
Yeah, I really, really liked Gerald's Game. I think it's maybe because it's been sort of King overload the last few months. I think is maybe the only reason, because there might be another Stephen King movie on my list.
There is on mine as well.
Yeah, but I really, you know, I've been a big fan of Mike Flanagan's for years. And again, and I think, you know, and I sort of said this because I just recently did a review for Before I Wake. The one thing that always I appreciate about him as a filmmaker is that he's not just set, you know, with his wheels in motion, just doing, you know, the same routine every single film. He's finding new and different ways to challenge himself as a storyteller. And there's probably no bigger challenge in the genre that came out this year than Gerald's Game, because as you said, it's almost an unfilmable book. And, you know, how do you translate these things and make it compelling while still honoring the story, but still, you know, being able to fulfill what you need, you know, to create a visual story too. And he does a good job. I think for me, the ending was a little, and again, it's, you know, I've never read the book, so I'm glad to know that was more of a Stephen King thing. I felt the, you know, there was some things where I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But how freaking cool is it to see Carol Struycken in there? You know, who I absolutely loved as Lurch. And he's a guy that I've actually had the pleasure of hearing about in stories, you know, because he's done a lot of makeup work over the years.
Right.
You know, he's, you know, and he's been in Twin Peaks and stuff like that too. So it was kind of fun to see him come in and be, is it the Moonlight Band?
That sounds right.
Yes. Okay. Yes, it is. I just happened to look it up. Yes. And also, you know, in terms of, you know, the material and certain aspects of the story that this year, you know, it makes it a little harder to see those things than maybe perhaps in previous years. Not that there's ever a good time to see any of that stuff, but the way that Mike handles it with as much grace as you possibly can, and finds a really good balance of, you know, making it an unsettling experience for viewers, but it's never like, you know, trying to be too exploitative either. I thought was really, really well done. So yeah. And I mean, Carla Gugino, like, oh my God, like, hello, how, that handcuff, man, holy shit. And it was funny, 'cause like, I was watching a screener of it. I think it was before Fantastic Fest, and Brian was sitting next to me playing a video game, and all of a sudden it was coming, like, happening. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, and he was like, what the hell's going on? And I was like, wait, I was like, you don't even need to see the rest. Just watch this. You don't even need to hear it. Just watch it. And he was like, oh my God, what's that?
Yeah.
And it's so, man, you know, you talk about like sort of those five moments, you know, up there for, in terms of like those just moments that hit you from horror in 2017. Yeah, that handcuff scene is right up there with, you know, get the keys, babe, or, you know.
Right.
I'm probably missing. Yeah, that's good stuff.
I thought they both had the same quality to them, where it was like, oh, God, I can't watch this. I so appreciate that every one of Mike Flanagan's movies are so much about their characters. And in more cases than not, female characters. I just think that that's where he comes from first and foremost, that it's not about the premise or the situation, that it's really about the people in the story. I would say Oculus is probably the closest to sort of premise based, but I think he digs enough into those characters that movie works as much as it needs to. But I've seen him get better, I think, with each movie, because I do think Gerald's Game is probably his best. I know Before I Wake came out, you know, after, but was made well before. And I didn't love it. I appreciate, again, that it's very much about the characters. You had mentioned a particular subplot in Gerald's Game. I think Henry Thomas doesn't get talked about enough. And, you know, he's somebody that Flanagan has worked with before. And what I so appreciate about Henry Thomas's performance as the protagonist's father in Flashback is that he's playing someone who's a monster, but he's not monstrous. Does that make sense?
Oh, no, it absolutely makes sense.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's, you could probably write a whole like dissertation about that performance if you really like went back and watched it. Because again, it's not even that much of the movie. You know what I mean? Like, altogether,
right,
maybe that's 5 minutes of the movie.
Right.
You know, maybe 7 minutes. But there's something so nuanced. Like, because if he would have gone a little too far with it in the other direction, man, you would have had a completely different performance. And there's maybe a movie I also saw recently that kind of does that. And I won't say it because I don't want to be a jerk.
Mm.
But it really shows what a little restraint and nuance can do for a subplot that involves this kind of material.
Have you ever seen Dolores Claiborne?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you know that the Eclipse is the crossover, right?
Yeah. I realized, like, I was like, oh my gosh. And honestly, like, it made me want to go back and watch Dolores Claiborne because I only saw it once at the drive-in when I was in high school.
It's really good.
I remember really liking it, but it's not one of my go-to Kings, I think. Just because I hadn't had enough experience with it. But yeah, it made me immediately go, man, I really need to rewatch Dolores Claiborne, because I got where that was, you know what I mean? Like, I got that moment, but at the same time, I was kind of like, damn it, if I would have realized, I would have. But again, I never read the book, so I didn't. I don't know if that's even a thing that's like referenced in. I don't know. Okay.
Yeah, because Carla Gugino even starts describing, like, I saw a woman and blah blah blah, and she's talking specifically about Dolores Claiborne. Stephen King, you know, has been doing this shared universe nonsense forever. So it's interesting to see the movie just play with that a little tiny bit. Obviously, we're getting a whole TV show based on that idea.
I thought Marvel invented that.
Yeah, you would think, right? No, turns out it was Stephen King.
Good for you, Mr. King.
Yeah. What is your next pick? This would be your number 5.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm not going to talk too much about it, but it's Cult of Chucky. That was
okay,
my number
yeah,
5.
Yeah.
And we already talked about it a bunch. So the only thing I want to say is I will be super duper heartbroken. And I'm so in the minority on this, and I get it. But if the next Chucky movie doesn't have Glenn and Glenda, I'm going to be really, really sad. Because I know Billy Boyd wants to come back. So that's all I'm just going to say. Let's just do it. Let's just freaking throw everything onto the fire and just let it go. And that's all I got to say about that.
Yeah, I guess this is going to start going faster now, because my 5 is The Black Coat's Daughter, which we've also talked about.
Yeah, I know. I have a feeling we're going to have some pretty big overlaps here. So
yeah, I might. Well, no, I've got 2 that. Well, all right, we'll see. So what is your 4?
Well, that's right, because you're going Black Coat's Daughter.
Yeah,
hold
my
on,
5
was
Black Coat's Daughter.
I was ill prepared. Okay, so this is another movie. No, that's okay. That I have talked about so much this year, and I almost feel like I'm a broken record at this point. But let's just throw that vinyl right back on the old turntable and let it spin again. And I'm going to go with Tragedy Girls.
Ah, damn it.
Because do you have Tragedy Girls on your list?
No, I haven't seen it.
Oh, well, shit.
It played Cinepocalypse, I think, like on the Friday night, and I couldn't go. And then it played at the Music Box for like one weekend at midnight or something. So I never got a chance to see it. And I know it's coming to
I know,
Blu-ray,
and it's
like...
not even coming to... Well, no, VOD first. I think it's coming to VOD in February. I think it's like the big news. And then I think eventually DVD and stuff.
Well, I'll see it on VOD then.
Yeah. I don't want to ruin, you know, a lot of what I love about it, because I know there is probably a bunch of folks who maybe haven't had a chance to see it, because it was very spotty.
Yeah.
The theatrical rollout was pretty spotty. But man, like, I don't know if it's just because, like, I am such a misanthrope these days and I'm a miserable old lady who sits in my house most days. But when you get two protagonists who are the antagonists, but yet the whole movie is built around them, like they're not the antagonists, and they just kind of hate everybody. I'm so on board for that. I really thought, because, like, I'm kind of going through this phase of like, all right, all the young kids need to get off my lawn because I'm old now. And I really, at first, like, I was expecting to kind of be put off by it. Like, I was, and I'm totally blanking on the name of that Joseph Kahn movie that he put out.
The Joseph Kahn one, Detention?
A few years ago.
Detention?
Detention. I was sort of, Detention. I was expecting a Detention experience because I was not a fan. Although I think
that's
both Josh Hutcherson, if I'm not mistaken.
That's the Darren Bousman thing, right? Detention experience?
Yes, the Detention experience. That's next one that they're going to do. They just put you in the Breakfast Club for like 3 hours and make you sit there. And then I think you get naked anyway or something like that. But yeah, I was, you know, like, I was kind of like, oh my God, are we in for a detention thing? Because I was just 30 seconds into detention and I was out. I was done. I was like, oh, you damn kids and your jibber jabbers and your LOLs and your bullshit. You know, so I didn't have that heart that I think, you know, is in Tragedy Girls. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, Tyler McIntyre is a really fun director. You know, I know Scott Drubbitz talked a lot about Patchwork, and he's right. It's a really great movie. I think that's on Netflix right now. And I just really like his sensibilities as a director. I like the fact that he's able to take these two horrible girls and still make you fall in love with them. There's a really good sense of humor to it. Kevin Durant has a really good supporting role in it. There's a really great sequence with Josh Hutcherson playing sort of this heartthrob guy that rolls in on his motorcycle, and it's all like this crazy, weird, dreamy music. It knows the kind of movie it's making, and it has fun with it. And, you know, also Craig Robinson is Big Al. Like, the scene, there's a scene with him in a gym, and it's also with Alexandra Shipp, and it's so great. And you think Craig Robinson being like sort of this, you know, comedy guy who's really had a solid career in comedy would be like the guy who steals that moment, and it's actually Alexandra Shipp. She's so funny in this movie, and the first time I watched it, I was all about Brianna Hildebrand. One, because I'm a big Deadpool fan, and I thought she was super, super fun in that. And I still quote a lot of the back and forth with her and Ryan Reynolds in that movie, because, you know, who doesn't look at teenagers these days and be like, oh, you just don't get it. So I was really like expecting her to be like my favorite part. But like the second time I watched it, I completely fell in love with Alexandra's performance. And I think she's sort of the heart of this story, and I love it. And I also love the fact that Elise Neal gets to play a mom in this, because it's like a really nice, you know, hat tip to Scream 2. And it's got a really fun cannibal Holocaust moment, which you wouldn't be expecting from this kind of movie. So for anybody who hasn't seen it, it does come to VOD. If you're a little more like, you don't like things that are kind of like on the nose with their humor, I don't know if you're going to love it. I freaking did, but, you know, I don't know. It's a really, if you've ever had a real, like, super duper long time best friend, like, it's such the perfect portrait, especially as a teenage girl. I don't know. We were just, you know, you're terrible when you're a teenage girl. And I think it captures the terribleness, but also the best parts of it too. And also a serial killing.
I'm in. I'm sold. I'll check it out, I guess.
I don't want to force the sizzle to do anything.
Stop it. I'm excited to see it and super bummed that I didn't get to see it before putting this list together. But unfortunately, we're in that limbo right now where there's no way to see it theatrically. There's no way to see it at home. So I'm just kind of stuck. But I will check it out as soon as it hits VOD. My next pick, we've talked about, it is Raw. I just thought it was a great, as you said, coming-of-age story, a great horror movie about women from a woman's point of view. One of the best sort of cannibal movies I've ever seen because of how sort of seriously it takes it. Which isn't to say that it's a humorless movie, because there's a lot of stuff in it that's real funny. I thought it had one of the best sister relationships I've seen in a movie in a long time. I just think it's the bee's knees, and it is on Netflix. So check it out, everyone.
Yeah, I don't even know what to say. Like, some of these movies I've been talking about for I'm like, oh my God, can I just stop already? Right. Like,
We'll end up talking longer about something like Psychopaths, because it's really the first time we've talked about it, you know, as opposed to my next three movies, which are all things that I've probably talked to death at this point. What is your number three?
All right. So my number three is, I mean, you know, for me, this was like just determining like which one of the three, like, was going to go one and which one was going to go two, yeah, and which one's going to go three. Cause like, you know, what else could you possibly do at this point? And I'm going to go with it.
Okay.
Like, it is it. I talk about movies you weren't expecting to be as good as they were. Mm-hmm. Like, all signs and indications going into this movie seemed like it was impossible to get this movie right. And that's nothing to say Annie Machete. Like, I like Mama fine, but there was nothing about Mama where I was like, oh my God, he has to take on it. But I don't know that I had any director where I was like, oh my God, he has to do it. So that Andy was able to be able to prove himself with it. And he does. You know, between the fact that, you know, which directors, and they had different scripts with completely different, you know, focuses on them. You know, I think the Kari Fukunaga script, like, Pennywise barely even talks. And now I'm like, you watch the final product of this it, and you're like, how the hell do you make a Pennywise movie and not let him talk? You know, but again, I'm also kind of enthralled with that concept too, because I'm like, well, how would you work that? And like, you know, so I mean, it's a movie that I wasn't expecting to just completely fall in love with as much as I did. I had a chance to see it actually, in July. I'm spoiled and I got to go see it early cause they were looking for notes, and I was like, holy shit, this movie is going to make so much money. You know, and I know everybody wants to talk like the Stranger Things, you know, factor. And frankly, I'm really terrible and I haven't even watched Stranger Things season two yet. I'm so bad. And it's not that I don't want to watch. It's just trying to find the time to invest in all those episodes. Yeah. But man, when you talk about like kids' performances being really fantastic, you know, the fact that Skarsgård was able to make Pennywise so wholly different than what Tim Curry did. And Tim Curry is a freaking, you know, genius, you know, when it comes to makeup performances, like, and to be able to do something so wholly different and do it just as memorably and make it his own. And it's like, holy crap. Like, I remember, like, you know, cause there's like a joke with the Scott from Birth, Movies, Death with, like, you know, Pennywise in the pipe. And when you first see that image, you're like, oh my God, really? That's the image. Yeah. And then it's like, holy, like, that's what you're expecting the movie to be. And it's like a complete 180. It's like so well made in terms of, you know, balancing out the heart, the horror, you know, finding that, you know, that voice of, like, you know, being a child, being a kid in the 80s, you know, being able to really develop these characters in a way that's worthy of, you know, what we had in the book. You know, and it's funny because I actually had somebody say to me, like, well, I didn't like the fact that they split it up where it's just the kids and then it's just going to be the adults. And I'm like, I love that they did that.
Yeah.
Because then you're just basically remaking the miniseries if you don't. And I think it was a really smart decision. I really hope that they're already doing some scenes before everybody grows up for the sequel, because it's not coming out for like another year and a half. But man, like, you know, I saw it three different times in the theater and it didn't get old with me at all. And I haven't bought the Blu-ray yet because it is so bare bones. And I don't know if there is really a director's cut Blu-ray coming or not, but I wasn't in a rush to buy a disc that I'm probably going to rebuy soon anyway.
My thinking is the same. And I mean, in theory, I'll just own both, but Warner's discs, you know, within 3 months, you'll be able to buy it for like $7.99 at Target. So I'm just waiting for that. And then if, you know, they come out with the director's cut, I'll pick that up too, maybe. But I'll have more to say about it in a few minutes. But yeah, I mean, everything you said is spot on. It's just, it's terrific. And I'm, even knowing that it was going to make a bunch of money, I don't think anybody on Earth predicted it was going to do as well as it did. When you look at, you know, how many movies it outgrossed this year, the fact that it was one of the five highest grossing movies, and it's this 2.5 hour rated R horror movie about a murderous clown. It's just so exciting for kind of what it did for horror. And I, of course, was annoyed by the backlash, but, you know, you just kind of tune that shit out. So I'll have more to say about it in just a minute. My number three is a movie that I know I've talked about with you, and I don't know if you've had a chance to see yet. Have you seen A Dark Song yet?
I have not yet. Okay. I'm really terrible. And I meant, because I was like, I know you're going to bring it up. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to watch it. And I just did not get to it this week. And I, like, it was in, like, it's on my shelf. Like, I'm ready.
Yeah.
Like, I should have done it, and I'm a jerk, and I didn't. And I'm very sorry for that.
No, it's okay. I hope you like it when you do see it. It's pretty straightforward. It's essentially a two-character chamber drama. And I don't have it in front of me in terms of, like, I know it's another debut. So my five was Black Coat's Daughter. That was a debut. My four was Raw. That was a debut. My three is A Dark Song. That's a debut. My two is a debut. So this is Liam Gavin, who's an Irish filmmaker. And it's essentially two characters, and I don't have their names in front of me, but they're both terrific in terms of, there's a woman, hold on, I'm pulling up their names just so as not to be a total monster.
We are total professionals,
Catherine,
everybody.
Catherine Walker is her name, and she has experienced a tragedy and goes to see an occultist who's Steve Oram from that movie that you love, the Ben Wheatley movie, Sightseers.
Oh my gosh. Now here we are bringing together the Sightseers.
That's right.
I had Alice Lowe.
You had Alice Lowe, right. So Steve Oram is this occultist, and she basically says, hey, I want you to do this thing for me. And the movie is essentially the process of him trying to conjure something, and it takes it very seriously, and it sort of takes us through the process and says, like, it's this really hard thing. Most movies that follow this same trajectory, it's like somebody buys a spell book and they read from it, or they, like, buy a haunted crystal or draw a pentagram on a floor or something. And this movie says, no, it's actually a ton of work and sacrifice and all this stuff that you have to do. And it gets to a certain point where I think 95% of movies chicken out, and this movie does not. And where it goes is amazing and scary. And as in the case of Hounds of Love, ultimately hopeful and beautiful. And I just think it's an amazing movie that not enough people talk about.
Honestly, like, if you would have said Steve Oram, like, the first time we ever talked about it,
so
I probably,
my fault.
It is. I literally would have hung up with you, whatever podcast we were recording that night, and I would just watch it immediately. I will, I have like five movies I have to watch before Sundance. Yeah. I'm going to find a way to make sure I watch this movie before the month is out. I guarantee it, but I'm so excited just knowing he's in it. Like, for me, that's already like my excitement level's at like a 6 because of that. Yeah. You know what I mean?
It should be at a 10 because I'm raving about it.
Yes. Well, you know, it's 9.5.
All right. Your number two.
So, I mean, literally my 1, 2, and 3, it could be a total toss up. Yeah. The only reason I went for number two for this is, even though this is my favorite movie of the year, because it's a horror list, mm-hmm. I feel like my number one qualifies a little bit more in that category. And so my number two is going to be The Shape of Water.
Yes.
To nobody's surprise. I like to stay on brand AF all the time. And again, I've talked about this movie so much, so it's like, who the hell even wants to hear me talk about Guillermo at this point? It's no secret. I love him. Like, I've loved everything he's ever done. Even his least effective work is still something that I've appreciated. And I don't even know what I would consider like his least effective, because I think everything works differently. Like, you know, as much as I didn't love the initial Mimic, going and now seeing the director's cut of a Mimic once they put that on Blu-ray, like, it's a totally different movie, and I completely get Guillermo's vision on that movie now. But with Shape of Water, I mean, it's such a special movie. I love the fact that it's, and it's not even like sort of cutesy in the talk of like the awards, like, oh, wouldn't it be cute if like Shape of Water got nominated? Like, it's winning awards, like serious awards. Like, and again, this sounds so stupid because I'm not one of those folks who puts a lot of stock into, you know, receiving statues and stuff like that. Like, I know there's a lot of pomp and circumstance, and ultimately none of it means anything. But I will tell you, getting to see Guillermo go up on stage at the Golden Globes and accept the Best Director award, like, I cried. I sound so stupid, but I did, because one, this man has everything that he does. It's not just like, oh, it's a whim of a project. Like, he spends like decades of his life investing in him. Like, I think Shape of Water was like 7 years of his life, you know, that because like I went, he did a talk on it Friday night at the Arclight out here, which was astoundingly fun and informative, and so many really cool things that I didn't even know. But like, you know, he started like doing maquettes of the creature in 2011. Like, and he'd been talking about this idea of the movie like a year prior. So this isn't something where he's like, I'm going to do, you know, this Creature from the Black Lagoon type movie. Like, right. He really puts himself into these projects. And I think, you know, even I like Crimson Peak a lot. I think I actually liked Crimson Peak a lot more the second time I saw it, because I think I really appreciated more of what he was doing. I still think it was way too expensive. But I love that ambition is right there on the screen, and that his, you know, black heart in terms of the tone of the material, like, is right there in front of us. And that, for as much as, you know, Tom Hiddleston wasn't his first choice for the male lead in that movie, like, then he kind of rewrites this whole universe, you know, that he created for these characters, and completely finds a way to make work in a different way. Like, he's just such a special storyteller when it comes to film. And I love the fact that it's being embraced. I don't know that we'll ever see this again. And I'm almost worried now that, like, maybe we sort of lose Guillermo's, our patron saint of genre films. Because I think, you know, if he takes home an Oscar, like, he's going to be offered pretty much anything he wants to do. And I hope, you know, I think his heart is so invested in the genre, I think he'll stick around. But I wouldn't begrudge him if he wants to go out and do a Marvel movie or something. Like, go get that money, Guillermo. You deserve it, you know? But I think for me, my favorite things is when he's doing stuff that he's created, that he's wholly invested in. And you can see the difference. Like, I think for me, like if you look at Hellboy 1, you can almost sort of tell that, like, he was kind of brought in for it. And then if you look at Hellboy 2, that's more of his heart. You know, and it's the same thing with like Blade 2. Like, I love Blade 2, but you can tell that was him working in somebody else's sandbox. And I just think for me, when he's working in his own sandbox, like Shape of Water, like, it's beautiful. Like, it's poetry. I could watch it again and again and again. And I just think the love story is created, like, he made it seem okay for like this woman and a fish man to have sex. And there was nothing weird about it. Like, that's like a thing that happens.
I might argue, and I love the movie. It's definitely one of my favorite movies of the year. I would only argue that I think he makes it seem okay to people like you and me, who are just on board for monsters already. And that's part of what we're loving about the movie, is that he so clearly loves this monster that he makes it his romantic lead. I think there's going to be a lot of, like, people who see movies at a mall who are like, what? That's weird. Do you know what I mean? Like, because
I get it to a degree, but like, honestly, like, I was looking at like different, like, people going in and out, because there was a screening of Shape of Water right as we were coming out of the talk, and it was mostly like normal looking folks. Like, I don't know how to explain it, but it didn't look like regular, like, artsy fartsy, like, old people in like their 50s or people that look kind of cool like us kids, you know, who are, you know, we weren't wearing the too cool for school, like, movie t-shirts and stuff. Like, it looked like typical. I mean, I guess I live in LA, so what is a typical moviegoer anyway? But I've heard more people who aren't quote unquote film people talk about this movie, you know, than I have film people. Like, I think that there's a genuine interest, and I think, you know, maybe there'll be a little bit of backlash. I'm sure the Oscar, you know, voters who are like over 70 will be like, what the hell is this thing? you know, but I think there's something that they almost make it endearing that she's in love with this like fish man, you know, for lack of a better term. And well, that she loves him even though he eats a cat.
Right. Not cool.
You know, and I think that's what the movie is about. Like, you don't love somebody when they're at their best. You love them when they're at their worst. And that's what real love is about, you know. And then one thing, like Guillermo said at the talk, that, you know, he's like, you know, it's so easy to put the person that you're in love with, you know, on a pedestal, because we all want to do that. We all want to take that thing that we love and, you know, elevate it. But at the same time, like, to really love something, you have to love it when it's at its lowest. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's important. And I think that's something that's interesting about the movie that maybe not a lot of folks are talking about, because, like, you know, there's a lot of really cute and lovely and charming things about the film, but it really explores both sides of what makes love true love.
Well, and I hope I'm wrong. I hope that people aren't weirded out by the sex in the movie. Yeah, because this is going to frustrate some people that I'm equating these two things, but I promise it makes sense in my head that, like, we have another movie that's out this year that's getting serious awards consideration, Call Me By Your Name, and it's about, you know, two young men who fall in love. And what's terrific about that movie is that it is never like, oh no, we're gay and is this wrong? It's just, hi, we're two young men and we fall in love, and it tells their story. And the movie, you know, there's a monologue at the end of the film that is essentially saying love is love and it doesn't matter, you know, and that's what The Shape of Water is saying. And one of the things that I like about it is that there aren't any characters in the movie who judge Sally Hawkins. She has several friends in the movie, Octavia Spencer, Richard Jenkins. None of them are like, what? That's gross. That's wrong. Stop it. What you're doing is wrong. Everyone's like, yeah, listen, love is love and we're happy that you found it. And so I'm glad that we have these movies that are coming out now. You know, we've made a great deal of progress, I think, in recent years in terms of understanding or accepting different sexual orientations and, you know, legalizing same-sex marriage, all this stuff. Of course, there's always going to be, unfortunately, those people who are awful and prejudiced and homophobic, and hopefully that stuff is being chipped away. And I think one of the ways to chip it away is through our representations in art that say love is love. And Del Toro's not saying, like, women should be allowed to fuck fish monsters, right? Because there aren't actual fish monsters. That's what's great about the movie, is that
it's we a metaphor. Know of.
See, well, exactly. But that the movie is essentially saying love is love. Find it where you can and hold on to it, you know? Yeah, no, I love that movie. My two, I'm guessing, is your one. So how about we roll them together, and I'll just let you say your number one since it's higher on your list, and then we can both talk about it.
Oh, okay. Well, do you have so then you're not – okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Should we say it at the same time? Like, you know,
no,
like
go ahead.
Like we're in grade school?
Just get the keys.
Get the keys, babe. yeah. Like, okay. So – when you're at a movie, I mean, sounded like so freaking elitist, and God, that sounds like such a douchebag thing, but, you know, it's part of the gig. It's part of what we do. And so sitting at Sundance and you're about to watch Get Out, and you feel the buzz. Everybody's like chitter chattering and we're all like, okay. And it was, honest to God, like one of my most anticipated movies, and it ended up being a surprise screening at Sundance. And of course we all come out of it. We're all cheering. We're all like high fiving. Like it's, like the room is like, if you could harness the electricity in that room, you could have powered the state of Utah for like 3 months on how that room was that night. And it was so great seeing Jordan up there, because he was like so nervous at the beginning, like his voice cracked and you could tell he was genuinely freaked out. Which is funny, because being a Key and Peele fan, like, you know, and being a fan of Keanu, also, like, I've never saw him like that. And it was like, whoa, he's really freaked out. And then, you know, when you're at a festival and there's always people are like, oh, well, everybody's just freaking out over the movie because you're at a festival. Like, it can't be that good. Like, that was literally the things that I was seeing on Twitter, like, because I completely fell over my own dick over it. Like that's, I knew what I saw was something special. I knew what I saw was something essential and vital to the conversation. That's the conversations that we need to be having, clearly, you know, because the world is a total, you know, shithole if you want. So like you just, you know, that feeling when you've seen something, it can monumentally change film in a way, like, you know, it's not like, it's not The Godfather, but you just know that there's something about this film that's so special that, you know, you just, you want to shout it from the rooftops. And then to have the validation when it comes out, to see people embrace it, because, you know, realistically, because there are a lot of racists in our country still, like, I was kind of surprised at how well Get Out did. But it's also a really fun experience when you go to the theater and you see the people who are leaving with their heads hanging down, or people who leave during the movie because you know you've pushed their buttons. And that's what good filmmaking should do. It should push buttons. It should make up, it should force conversations that we need to be having. It should make people hold up a mirror to themselves and face that ugly truth that, you know, maybe an under, in other circumstances or the other art forms, maybe we wouldn't do that. And I just think what Jordan Peele has done is so incredible with this film, you know, and just being able, again, to see a movie like Get Out being talked about for awards. Like, it, I made a joke about it. Like, oh, I think I just saw the first Oscar contender for 2017 or whatever. And I was kind of joking, but in the back of my head, I'm like, well, that'd be really fucking cool. And here we are. We're having serious conversations about Get Out as a, as an Oscar contender. How amazing is that? That this guy who, you know, has been doing sketch comedy for so many years, in any other circumstance, nobody would have taken a chance on him, and Blumhouse did. And that, you know, it's like, for everybody who wants to, like, you know, crap on Blumhouse, like, oh, this or that or whatever. Look, they're the ones who are out there, you know, giving opportunities to directors that not a lot of studios would. They're out there making movies that are making money, and they're turning profit in a way that is beneficial to the genre. And they're putting out things that we're not really seeing. Like, you know, we had Happy Death Day. We had Split. We had Get Out. It wasn't like we were getting three Paranormal knockoffs.
Right.
You know? And I think they deserve a lot more credit than they get. It's just like, it's always like a joke. Well, what's Blumhouse going to, you know, it's like, I'm tired of that, because holy crap, like, they've done some great stuff. And even outside of the genre, they've done like Whiplash and stuff. Mm. And I just think, like, it's one of those films, like, it's going to be a vital part of any film conversation for the next 20 years and beyond, I think. Like, it's a movie that you can always, there's always a discussion to be had, if that makes sense. And also, I mean, it's just like, man, like how screwed up is our world that, like, we almost have to make these movies because we wouldn't have these conversations otherwise.
Well, and what part of what I think is so brilliant about the movie is that it isn't just saying, like, hey, people are racist and that's bad. It's not, it's confronting the people that don't think they're racist. And that is what I think is so kind of clever and fascinating about the movie, is that it's approaching sort of white liberal racism, not kind of that ingrained Southern, you know, Union flag or Confederate flag waving racist. It's an East Coast liberal Obama voter racism. And, you know, we could talk for hours about the messaging of the movie, which is what makes it super relevant to right now. But it's also just a brilliantly made movie. It's super smart and funny and entertaining and inventive and introduces ideas and visuals that you've never seen in a horror movie before, and is like one of the most confident horror debuts I've seen in a long, long time. And, you know, again, right away, like you said, as soon as I saw it, I was like, well, that's an all-timer. You know, like, it's rare that I don't even know that something like It may be an all-timer. You know, I mean, we're falling in love with it now, and I think it will always be talked about in terms of really great Stephen King adaptations. I don't know if 20 years from now we're still going to be like, oh my God, it. But I think Get Out is a genuine all-timer, and that's very exciting. So, yeah, it's a great pick. It's my number two, only because I put It at my number one, because It it's just personal preference. Like, I would probably make a case that Get Out is a better movie if we're going to sort of chart these things out, because I think there are problems with it in terms of some of the repetitiveness of the structure that are not true of Get Out. But those things in it, I overlook, because the things I love about it, I just love unconditionally. And it's not a horror movie. You know, a lot of times when I say I love a movie, it's like, I want to live in this movie. And that's obviously not true, because I don't want to be terrorized by a murderous clown, but I want to live with this movie forever. I like the way I feel watching it. It pushes a lot of my buttons in terms of the nostalgia stuff and the stuff with the kids and the relationships and the characters. And then it's got monsters and clowns and scary stuff and haunted houses and, I just love it, you know.
Can I jump in for 1 second?
Yeah.
I literally lost you for 25 seconds.
Okay.
So I'm like, I think he's now talking about it. So I was like, oh, thank God he didn't realize I was gone. Sorry to break the fourth wall.
That's okay.
Everybody.
That's okay.
Hey, he's talking about murderous clowns. Is there like a different cut of Get Out I haven't
seen
yet?
Yeah, you haven't seen that one. No, I had said that, you know, that Get Out is great and probably a better made movie, but my heart belongs to It, which is why I put it at my number one. And honestly, you know, we do our episode on our favorite movies of the year, and then you and I do our favorite horror movies of the year. And a lot of times I kind of separate those out because, you know, again, I'd rather talk about more movies than fewer. So I don't often put horror movies on my favorites of the year, and I rarely will put my favorites of the year on this list. And there's way more overlap this year in terms of, like, Get Out was on my favorites list. And this is the first year, I think, since we've been doing F This Movie that my number one for the year is also my number one horror movie of the year, and that's It. So it's the first movie to ever get the top slot on both lists. But
I'm sure Andy Muschietti will be waiting for his award.
Yeah, he's
going to be sitting home. I think I just called him Muschietti. Like,
you
he's
did.
Paschetti.
Paschetti. Yeah. Andy Paschetti.
Andy Paschetti.
And this is something I've said before, too. I'm so nervous about Chapter 2, because if they fuck it up, it's going to diminish Chapter 1.
I know, right? But I just, here's the thing. None of us were expecting number one, the first one, to be as strong as it was.
Right.
So I'm just, I have to hope that they know what they're doing at this point. Like, I want it to be amazing. I want it to really give me, you know, that wallop. And again, I don't know. I think to do that, because the way King writes, sometimes he does sort of write these unfilmable ideas that don't translate very, very well visually, but they, you know, read really great in a book. And I kind of am okay if they take some liberties, to be honest.
Like, don't include Space Turtle. Like, please leave Space Turtle out of the movie.
And I don't want them to fight a giant spider.
No.
You know what I mean?
No.
But I feel better about part two, you know, because part one exists.
Yeah.
So I just gotta, you know, just don't F it up.
Right.
That's all we ask.
Right.
That's all we ask, Warner Brothers. You can screw up everything you want to do with DC and whatever.
Oh, they're
just
way
please.
Ahead of you on that.
Oh, I know. They've been working around the clock on that. But just let them do the It movie they want to do, and don't, like, micromanage. I think they know that they don't have to, you know, have those reins as tight this time. So
yes and no. Like, on the one hand, I would say, yeah, of course, you know, because.
But because it made so much money, they want to make sure
exactly.
It made so much
so
money.
So now, there. All of a sudden, everybody's interested, like, because, hey, we got to do that 300 again. So.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway.
I will tell.
It is, you know, it was just a great year for the genre. And, I'm hoping this year is very good as well. I know you saw a handful of things at festivals that are getting a release this year that that I'm really looking forward to. I saw a couple things at a festival that I know are coming out this year that would have been on my list if we were putting out, you know, putting movies that we saw at festivals on our list. So I appreciate that you wait until everybody can see it. But so I already know a few spots are probably taken on my list for next year because I've already seen these movies. So I'm excited about this year as well.
I know it's weird because it's like, you know, because I do like sort of the calendar and stuff to kind of manage like all the upcoming releases and stuff. And to be honest, one of my most one of my movies I was the most excited for is now not even coming out till next year. So it shifts it a little bit for me where I'm a little more nervous now because there's nothing when I look at the calendar that completely jumps out at me where I'm like, oh my God, yes. Well, do you know what I mean? Like, I know it's going to be
Halloween, right?
Well, yes. I'm hopeful.
Yeah, no, I am too. I'm curious. I'm not positive it's going to be great, but I'm like,
I'm still really nervous just because of what we've learned about what they're doing with the story.
Sure.
I'm going to trust. I'm giving them my trust. We're doing a trust fall. I've trusted Blumhouse before and I think they're going to be okay. But there's a part of me that it's probably the most worried I've been about like a franchise sequel in a long time. Like, I don't even think I was this worried about It. But I'm very worried about Halloween, but not like, I don't think they're going to do a good job. I just don't know until I guess I see it, how that the decisions about sort of retconning most of the entire franchise is going to work to their favor because fans, you know, for most folks, it's not going to matter, but for us horror freaks, like, it's going to matter. So you better make sure that there's a payoff.
For me, it will. And it won't, honestly, where it's like, I don't care if they ignore most of it. If they give me a Halloween that I like, both things can coexist in my head, you know, where it's like, okay, this is sort of the sequel to two. And then there's all these other movies that I can also watch. So I'm cautiously optimistic. What is the movie that moved off of 2018?
New Mutants.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I was really excited for that. And I wasn't really super on board with it until I saw the trailer finally. Cause I just, I'm so bad again, getting to see movies for fun. I just finally saw Thor last weekend. Because I'm like, oh, I should probably see this before it's not in theaters anymore. And this is the worst part is that we missed Doctor Strange in theaters cause Brian was working on a movie back then. So that's been sort of a bone of contention. So, and we still haven't even watched it on Netflix. There's no excuse for us. So we're watching Thor. And of course, who shows up is Doctor Strange. And all of a sudden Brian's like, and I was like, I know we're going to watch it. We're going to watch it. You know, he's like, I'm probably not understanding any of this because I should have seen Doctor Strange. I was like, I know, I'm sorry. It's all that shared universe crap. Way to go, Stephen King. but there was the new Mutants trailer was before, and I hadn't watched it previously. I know it had come out online, and I was like, oh, holy crap, that looks cool. Like, it's like, looks like a straight up horror movie. And it really, like, in terms of sort of the medical horror and that kind of stuff, I was like, yes, this looks fantastic. And then they're like, no, we're going to push it till February, which I'm guessing means that because they're moving forward with Gambit, there's going to be some sort of tie into Gambit because of, I think New Mutants will then fall like 3 or 4 months before Gambit comes out. So I don't know. I mean, I'm going to trust it, but I was really, really psyched for that this year. And I'm pretty bummed that we're not getting it, but you know, maybe if I lived in a multiverse, I could go to a different universe and get to see it in February.
Can't
like I'm supposed to.
I can't believe Wish Upon didn't show up on either of our lists.
Right? I know. Risky's going to be so sad. We're sorry. We are sorry. But in a but in another universe, we totally both had it on our list.
That's right. anyway, thank you guys very much for listening. As you can hear, my voice is about to go, so we'll wrap it up. Another good year for horror movies. Thank you for listening. Heather, where can people find more of you online?
Oh, they don't need more of me online.
Everybody does.
Well, I'm not the sizzle, so I don't know if I agree with that.
All you want. It's not catching on.
It is so catching on. We're going to make this happen. You wait. I'm over at dailydead.com, and on Twitter, you can find me at The Horror Chick. And that's it. I don't do anything else.
No, not at all.
No.
You can also order The Monster Squad on Amazon. You should. Do it.
Oh, yeah, that too. Sorry.
Yeah,
yes. There's
trying to sell a book here, people.
Yeah.
You can find more of our stuff at fthismovie.com, and we're on Twitter at fthismovie. Rate and review us on iTunes if you haven't already. And if you're a fan of listening to me and Heather talk about horror, you can check out Corpse Club every Friday at dailydead.com or corpseclub.com. We will be back next week. I don't know what we're talking about yet, but stick around. Hopefully it'll be something good. Thanks again, Heather. This is always a blast to do.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm so glad we got to do this once again till next year.
Yeah, right.
That's probably literally the next time you'll have me on. So.
No. You'll be back.
Buzzing.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to F This Movie.